It's Tuesday, April 4th, 2017, and you're listening to episode 438 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 58 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Brodor.
This is Eric.
Carla.
All right, so we have Eric here. Somebody asked if this was a crossover between Fear the Boot and Gamer Stable. Since you won't capitalize it, I'm putting the break wherever I damn well feel like
it's like PetSmart, right? Yeah.
Precisely.
PetSmart?
And the answer is no. What Fear the Boot does is we just outlive everybody and then come in and pick the best parts off the carrion. This isn't a crossover. This is just us taking what's left as great empires fall away around us.
You're so humble. My goodness.
Yeah. Isn't his humility what attracted you to him in the first place?
Sure.
You want to know what's weird? What did attract you to me in the first place?
Your teeth.
Because they're straight and
because
white?
Because they're beautiful.
Yeah. Isn't that such a strange thing?
You never had braces, did you?
No, I did.
Okay.
I did, and that finally paid off. You know, I was not happy when I was having them.
Right.
But it's just such a strange thing, you know, because I'm looking at her tits and she's looking at my teeth. And it's like, what?
Oh, my goodness.
What kind of relationship are we off to here?
So you were all smiles at that point.
Yes. So, all right. So Eric is, or was, or I don't know. What is your guys' state? What is the state of Gamer's Stable right now?
We are on permanent or semi-permanent hiatus.
Okay. So you're kind of in Dragon Landings and episode 99 territory.
Right, right.
You'll totally be back.
We still exist. It's more like the world of Greyhawk. We still exist in theory.
In theory.
So, well, unlike Greyhawk, I care what happens to your show.
Damn. So we have Eric joining us because, well, for anyone who doesn't know a whole lot about gaming media, I'm talking about podcasts, but in particular blogs to a lesser extent, particularly podcasts. If you were to detonate a wide area nuke in St. Louis, Indianapolis, and Chicago, pretty much tabletop role-playing game podcast would cease to exist. I mean, I guess you would still have Stu and Happy Jacks out on the West Coast, and there'd be a few survivors dotted here and there, but it would be the Jericho moment. It would be the apocalypse from which only a few enclaves would survive. And so Gamer Stable happened to be right across the river from us over in the western, southwestern part of Illinois,
right,
which for anyone who doesn't know their geography, St. Louis sits right on the western bank of the Mississippi River within a stone's throw of Illinois. So we asked Eric to come by and visit us. And so here he is. And so, Eric, we're actually going to start the show with a topic where you've got the expertise, definitely your wheelhouse.
Okay.
There's a long-held concept or truism that we've had on this show that Chad first stated, and I've largely assented to, which is that gaming is not a spectator sport, that it's rather uncomfortable for the players to have some third party, a non-gamer, a roommate, whatever it is, husband, wife, whomever, lurking around in the background. And people that say they want to sit there and watch it, I mean, they might get some enjoyment out of it, but it's never the same as actually playing the game. Now, my view on that started to shift an episode or two ago when I was talking to Carla and asked her, you know, what got you interested in gaming? And part of her answer was it was watching the games that I was playing with my friends and hearing the stories and the characters and such. And that was partially what drew her into the hobby. And as Brodor astutely pointed out, as somebody who's at least aware of the calendar, that we're headed into con season, right? So lots of people listening to this show are going to be gaming in front of other people. And this could be other gamers or tag-alongs you drug to the convention, or people who are between events who just happen to stop by your table to observe the action. What I want to pick your brain on is, so what makes for good spectator sport gaming?
Well, I think that, first of all, Carl, that's not the first time I've heard that. A friend of mine, Greg, his wife got into gaming the exact same way, where he was playing with his friends and she was in the other room trying to read because you can't really have the TV on or anything like that or do anything, you know, loud because there's a game going on, and just listening to the stories and seeing how things progress and getting interested in the storytelling aspect of it. I think when it comes to doing a game in front of people, and anybody who's GM'd at a con knows this, that showmanship's part of it. And the better the showmanship of the game master, the more people are going to start paying attention. Gen Con, for example, you get some of those, what are they called, quacks or cacks or whatever, the one game where they yell and scream and they stand on top of their chairs and they're and completely disrupt the entire room. Everybody,
there's a game like that at Fear the Con too. I don't know. It's something, what is it that they're always saying? Something, I don't
all
know.
Hail King Torg?
Maybe that's what it is.
It's Kobolds Ate My Baby.
Okay.
Is one for a lot of raucous, obnoxious behavior.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No. And see, that's a good example of that is, you know, a lot of times people are having so much fun playing those games. You're sitting there trying to play your game going, I kind of wish I was playing that game, you know, because so many people take it so seriously and don't want to, you know, disrupt, or they don't want to, you know, put any kind of pizzazz into it. And whenever you have a game master who can do these things, it's theater.
Well, I just want to add in there, like, just a kind of a clarification with the gamer, or gaming is not a spectator sport. I think there's a different level of what do you define spectator as? So for me, you know, like you're talking about, if you hear people having a really great time, you're like, man, I want to be a part of that. And you might watch it because it's just enthralling to watch. That's completely different than I want to buy a ticket to watch people sit around and play a game. Like, it's the reason why you're there is different. So I think if you're planning to go just to watch, that's where I think it's more like spectator like.
Right.
But to be immersed in the environment, you're going to want to be kind of included if people are enjoying themselves. So I just want to draw out that context because, you know, I'd be curious what if Chad is just meaning a blanket statement that you shouldn't have anybody watching. But again, I think it's, why are they there? That defines what spectator is.
There was some context to Chad's truism, which lies in kind of the way I set it up, that it's often uncomfortable for the people that are gaming to have somebody observing. And the person that's observing is not quite going to get the same experience. That's not to say they can't have a positive experience, or they can't get something, or maybe have gaming demystified for them. You know, see that you're not actually killing a goat or whatever it is they think you're doing. But
there's a level of voyeurism, though, that is uncomfortable for a lot of players.
Yes.
This person is lurking in the corner and baiting while we make love. It's just uncomfortable unless you're really into that.
Wait, there's
welcome,
something,
welcome
there,
to the show.
There's something wrong with that? Wait a minute. It's Friday night.
But no, a lot of... He says Friday night. That's Saturday night.
But a lot of people are uncomfortable with that. There needs to be an expectation. So I think that in my basement, hanging out with my friends, and my buddy's girlfriend's going to come over, that might be uncomfortable for us. Right. Now, we might get her interested in gaming, which is great, but I think a lot of it depends on the venue. At a convention, true. I think you need to expect that this is going to occur and plan accordingly. Certainly, if you are gaming in your friendly local game store, you absolutely have an expectation that this is going to occur, and it's going to be encouraged,
yes,
and that you should plan accordingly.
Well, you are part of the ad for the products.
Right.
And yeah. I'll be honest with you in that. That is one of the reasons why...
Why you quit playing Vampire?
No. That's a restraining order. and well-reasoned one at that. I didn't even fight it. I'm like, you are right, Your Honor. LARPing in public should be absolutely objectionable behavior, and I should be monitored as a danger to myself and others.
Sustained.
And I actually filed it against myself on behalf of the Denny's Corporation.
But holy crap.
That's the second time.
That was comedy gold.
But this wasn't the point I was going to make, but I'll just go with this one instead because I remember it now after that derailment. Was, Eric, there's something you said about showmanship that I think is great, which is the qualities that make a game entertaining to watch may very well overlap quite heavily with the exact same qualities that make a game entertaining to participate in.
Right.
I mean, we have certainly on this show praised game masters who aren't afraid to be a little bit stupid, to look a little bit foolish, you know, to get up on their chair and to do the voices and to really be into it, to set that tone of enthusiasm, to lead by example. And it's those kinds of things that when I'm at a convention, even if I'm in my own game, if there is a table next to mine or two or three over where people are doing that, it draws attention. I mean, I may even be the game master and it draws my attention to what they're doing.
Right.
I mean, goodness gracious, there's certain people at Fear the Con, we have to put them in a room by themselves. Bob Arns is a great one, partially because he's loud, but also because he's incredibly foul. But he's not the only one. There's a few people that we specifically have to kind of isolate a bit because they're a bit too much of an attraction.
Challenge accepted.
Well, question about that, though. I mean, do you find that you have people who go to conventions that just get annoyed with that kind of stuff? Like maybe there's GMs that are more, maybe just more subdued, maybe not, maybe they're soft-spoken, but they really love the act of GMing, and maybe they just get too distracted and too...
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. That has been a concern that we've had voiced at our convention, and one we have done our best to accommodate, which is people that want either a more subdued game to begin with, or they just don't feel like yelling over. I mean, maybe right. Everyone's right. Perfectly engrossed in their game, but they've gone hoarse from yelling all weekend, and so they migrate off to a side somewhere, or even send us a request ahead of time right. Saying, could you please put us in a more separate area so we don't have
to compete, yeah.
Or send us a request ahead of time to say, can you put us somewhere more segregated so we don't have to compete like that?
Yeah, I know the last game that I ran, or the only game I've ever run at Fear the Con, I certainly, and apologies to those around us, I was a distraction to the nearby tables for sure.
Yeah, let's talk about that because this was sixth slot. This is the end of the con. So anyone who's not already got a few drinks in them, the reroll mechanic was you could have as many rerolls as you want. But each reroll cost
a shot of Jack
shot
Daniels.
Of Jack.
Yep. Oh,
was this your brainchild?
Yeah. So the patented Brodor You Tell Me system, you have a list of skills and powers on your character sheet that are undefined. You tell me how it works. You roll a D12 because it's the most rock and roll of the dice. Everything's target number 7, right? So I'm using the skill. I'm justifying the roll. It's target number 7. I failed. I'm going to take a shot of Jack to reroll. Done.
Nice.
Yeah. You can have a designated drinker because I know Mr. Wells was a lot of people's designated drinker. That guy, whew, he's a stud.
John became mine. So, Eric, could you expound on that a little more about the attributes that make somebody a good game master in general? That just so happened to carry over into the showmanship of a third party.
The best game masters that I've ever played with were able to adjust to what was going on with the players and whatnot. But usually it's they're putting the enjoyment of the players ahead of their own enjoyment. And like you said, willing to do goofy things, willing to do things that maybe are a little bit off the wall or maybe even uncomfortable things. I've always found that putting people in uncomfortable situations always makes them, you know, a little bit more loose at the table, especially when you're running like a con game. You throw in something just completely random or just off the wall to begin with, and it kind of breaks the ice a little bit. Because
right.
When you're playing at a con, it's you're playing usually with strangers or people, you know, that maybe you've met once or whatnot, and you're a little bit timid. Some people aren't, but, you know, a lot of, as you're running the game, you're looking around, you can tell who's going to be the most boisterous and things like that. So if you can break the ice with them, maybe with a little ad lib at the beginning or, you know, silly voices. I like to do silly voices, things like that. I think for most people doing things.
You threw out uncomfortable situation. Now, I know you well enough to know that we're not talking about something that's genuinely distressing. Can you give me an example of one you would use?
Well, like just being utterly flamboyant. Anybody who's played the 5th edition D&D Storm King's Thunder, for example, has almost kind of a throwaway character. He's this cloud giant who rides around in this cloud with a tower on it. And as I'm looking at it, it looks like a high-heeled boot. And I'm like, who would ride around in a cloud? In the
yeah, exactly.
So his name is, and so that's the voice I would use. And
I would picture in a fluffy cloud with a giant tower coming off the top, high heeled shoes, not yeah, what I was saying. Right,
yeah. So yeah, so you know, it was like a very very flamboyant. You know, I'm going for, you know, Dr.
There's a low spark everywhere. Somebody in the audience got it.
You know, so I'm thinking Dr. Frankenfurter, you know, I'm you know, I'm wanting to do the giant version of that, right? You start using the goofy voice like that, no girl, and things like right. that, and you know, you flail your arms and you be as over the top as you can be, and even the most stick up their butt person sitting there is gonna laugh, and it's gonna break the ice, and it's gonna get people thinking about, oh, this game, you know, this I would like to play in this game. I ran that in a not it wasn't at a con, it was in a game shop. And people were like turning and looking like, what in the world are these guys playing? And had people asking, you know, hey, what are they playing? Oh, we've got that game right here. You know, so like you said before, you have to be almost like an ambassador for the games themselves when you're running in a game shop.
You know, something else that I found that helps with the showmanship is movement. The human eye is attracted to motion. It's just the way it works. Our brains filter out an enormous amount of stimuli. But motion tends to get picked up. And one of the games that I run at pretty much every Fear the Con, I'll probably do one at Fear the Con 10, is the Star Trek ship-on-ship simulation.
Some hot ship-on-ship action.
Some hot ship-on-ship action. So, you know, 5-on-5. So, I mean, it's just...
With me baiting in the corner.
but one of the parts of that game is the fact that you have this limited amount of time to discuss things with your bridge crew. You're not allowed to discuss. You're not allowed to pass notes. We try to make it as immersive as possible.
It's a lot of fun.
And so you have these breaks where you have 10 seconds to do everybody on the bridge talking to each other.
To do everybody on the bridge.
Yeah, 10 seconds to everybody on the bridge. So I hope you're not in it for her pleasure. And the point being, though, that because of the fact that the bridge crews should not overhear each other, because that's they're planning strategies and feints and whatever, they get up and they walk to different parts of the room. And then when they come back to try and maintain the double blind, I then walk around the table and individually whisper to or pass note cards with each of the people at the different bridge stations. And so there's a lot of movement. The players are moving. I'm moving. There's constantly people getting up, sitting down. You know, I'm counting down their 10-second opportunities to talk. And this usually is, this is one of the games that oftentimes gets put in its own room because of the fact that it requires a lot more than one table to play because there's all this motion involved with it. In the same way that, as we've talked about so many times, when Chris stood up on that chair and started flailing his arms as the Ogre King or whatever he was supposed to be, that got people's attention. Mm-hmm. And so motion, I think, is a great way to draw people in.
Chris climbed up on a table.
It was a chair. Yes.
With his bad hips and things
like that. His bad hip, his bad knee.
He extended his walker. His walker. It's like a Mr. Gadget thing.
You with the amount of it's ever since that year we've had to carry insurance.
It's like one of those walkers that doubles as a seat. You right. can just turn around and stand on yeah. it for GMing.
I think the thing that you hit on earlier, Eric, the actual figure of speech that you used when training employees when I used to run the fantasy shops was ambassador of the hobby. And that was exactly the kind of culture that we wanted to cultivate with the clientele. And so we had experiences with people running games in the shops who were annoyed by passers-by coming over, asking questions, observing the game. They didn't like that. And our answer was always very politely, I appreciate where you're coming from. If you wanted solitude, you should play elsewhere. Right. And it's not us trying to be jerks. It's just we're running a business. We are providing a space for you to play these games. Part of the social contract that we have is that you're going to have to accept that people are going to observe. They may ask questions, and it helps build the community for everybody.
Another move I found that works wonders is if you don't want an observer, don't let them be. Now, some people are going to really strongly decline this, and there's nothing you can do about that. But when I get a passerby, if they stand there for more than a few seconds, I draw them in. I make them an NPC. Mm-hmm. You know, they're sitting there in a tavern, you know, generic sort of RPG scene, and they're talking. And then one of the characters might say something like, you know, well, I say something, this, this, and this, and it's kind of rude to the barkeep. I say, you know, it's a pretty dirty establishment you got here, Larry. And I'll suddenly turn to this random passerby and say, Larry, he just assaulted your tavern, and pull him right in. At one of the Fear of the Cons, I had somebody show up to the game who had just misread his schedule.
Right.
He wasn't on the game. He wasn't supposed to be there. I'm like, you know what? I actually have a fairly major NPC. If you're willing to kind of loosely follow a script I give you, you want to play the main bad guy? And I just dealt him in, so yes, to speak.
Please.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I don't let them be. You know, if you're going to sit at the table or stand near the table, I'm going to at least make an attempt to include you.
There's a good slot six activity, is that the hosts don't game. We're just going to walk around and volunteer to be NPCs. That's it. We're just like, do you need an NPC? I'm in.
That actually would be a cool thing to do. Just wander around. Yeah, we should do that. That's totally something we should do at Fear of the Con. If not 10, then 11. Is we should have people that sign up for a slot as roving NPC, and like give them like a big badge or a t-shirt that says like, I'm an NPC. And if they walk up to a table, they have volunteered that whatever it is you need, whether it's for 5 minutes or whether it's for the remainder of the slot, that they're your bitch.
That is a fun idea. Yeah, that'd be a great way to get in a bunch of games. And
right.
Yeah. And have like just 3x5 cards of all your NPCs. The game master would have all those notes anyway.
Well, that would be really cool for us to meet fans and hang out and to be able to participate in gaming and not have to prepare a damn thing.
The lazy truth.
Yeah.
Yes. It's why Chad runs games like Inspectors and such, because he doesn't have to prepare anything. But yeah, I think that would actually be a really fun idea. So, Eric, something else I want to talk about while we're on this topic is obviously your show was an actual play show. Chris provided voices for it. I did a voice for it.
Right.
I was one of your players' dads.
Yes.
And still
she
am. Still,
and I was like, she still can, tweets at you as dad.
I still am her dad. And I just generally post vague condemnation of everything she's doing.
Yeah. It's your children will be a disappointment.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Since I don't have my own children to be disappointed in, and I'm too nice of an uncle, I have to have somebody to judge. Yeah. And so I judge her all the time for not living out life the way that I wish I had. And all the poor choices. I mean, she's in her 20s. She's making a lot of poor choices right now. That's
so cool.
And I just get to be there and just, you know, just say whatever. And it's great. But that's something that we as a show have not attempted. And we might at some point. It is a Patreon level where we do, I don't know if it's actual plays or just kind of more a voyeuristic thing. If we just game people, because I don't remember what it is. But the point being that one of the things that's always kind of made us hesitant about this is it seems like actual plays have one of two extremes. It's either easy to not produce them at all, meaning you record the game, you maybe cut out some of the really messed up and pointless stuff like bathroom breaks or bickering about the rules for 30 minutes or whatever, but you generally just release the play session as it occurred.
Right.
And then on the far opposite extreme, you have something like what you guys did, which is very highly produced, where you completely cut out even the game master stuff, replaced with narration. You have volunteers like Chris or me that come in and play the voice roles of the NPCs, and you take what was an RPG and turn it into audio drama.
Right.
And to give the people listening a little bit of an idea of how the sausage is made, when we edit a... Don't look at that, Brodor.
I'm shaking my head and he's looking at me.
When we cut an episode of Fear the Boot, I don't know exactly how long it takes Aisha, but at least when I was editing it, depending on who was on it, it typically ran from about a 2 to 4 times multiplier. And sometimes it would go much higher than that. But what I mean by a 2 to 4 times multiplier is each hour of audio would take somewhere between 2 and 4 hours to edit, tending towards the higher end. So tending towards the 3 to 4 hour range. And so I was asking you out of curiosity when we were at dinner, I said, so how long did it take you to produce one of these?
Yeah.
And what was the figure you gave me?
Each 4-hour game session is usually between 20 to 25 hours each.
And that's for, is that for the whole 4 hours, or is that?
That's, well, that would be for one 45-minute episode.
So one installment.
Yeah.
So, okay, so about 45 minutes of released content took somewhere between 20 and 30 hours
right.
to produce. Damn. I understand why you're sitting in my recording studio now.
Right, right.
What did you learn from that? I mean, from, and not, I don't mean specifically just from the editing length,
right.
but from the whole ordeal of trying to balance production versus having a life versus taking something that may have only mixed value as third-party entertainment and turning it into third-party entertainment.
Right.
You have to have a repository of knowledge on this.
Well, first and foremost, I have a wonderfully supportive wife. She knew that when I was closed off into my area doing what I was doing, she was okay with that. So I have to give her props first, because that's ultimately, that's the reason why I was able to do these things. But the thing that I learned first and foremost is that for the most part, you're right. Listening to someone else play a game, unless you're playing, unless you're one of the people who just love to play the game, is usually pretty boring. It's pretty dry stuff, because nobody thinks that your game is as cool as you think it is, right?
Sure.
So, you know, you listen to a lot of actual plays, and people just put the Yeti in the middle of the table and just let it ride, right? So those are generally, I would consider, on the low end of the spectrum. And then what I wanted to do was to make it more of a radio drama. My friend Dan said, you know, hey, let's, if we're going to do this, and I'd been actually needling them to do it for a while. And then finally, I'm just, as I do, I kind of just say, we're doing this, and we would do it. And we started off with a game of Victoriana. And it's much more of a traditional actual play than it is like a produced drama. And I kind of got the bug then, and I thought, well, maybe, you know, put a little bit more production value into it. You know, cutting out, as I'm running the game, a lot of the Game Master stuff. What I learned from all of that is it almost became a crutch, because I could run these games, and in the back of my mind, I can always think, I'm not going to hear any of this stuff. Nobody's going to hear any of this stuff. So I would save a lot of stuff for the production value part of it, the narration and the things that I wrote. And the players, after the fact, would go, well, that's not anywhere near the game that we played.
So do you think they feel like they missed something, like they missed out, that the production was better than the game experience they had?
I think, yes, absolutely yes. The reason I say that is because when I did my Shadowrun, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to totally give it away if anybody wants to listen to it, but there is a point in that story where people at the table were like, I don't know what is going on. And to kind of go into it, what it was I was feeding the players information individually through text, but what I was doing was I was sending them different information. So almost as if this was your perception of what was going on or what had happened. And they were getting so confused. They were thinking that I'd completely lost my mind, and that I had forgotten what I had told so-and-so and what I had told so-and-so. And they were, I would separate them, like what you were saying about the Star Trek game. I would separate the players and bring in just two people to play, and then I would bring other people in and things like that. They would go into the other room and have fights over the things that, no, Eric said this and you did this. And, you know, they would argue with each other. And once it was all said and done, they were like, we had no clue what was going on. You had us completely lost. It was to the point where it was so much not fun for them that at least three of them will never play Shadowrun again. and that makes me sad, because it's like, you know, I love Shadowrun so much. And to have people say, I don't really like that game, because it was their first impression of the game. It's kind of disheartening for me, because I was like, you know, I want it to be fun. I want people to love it as much as I did. But, you know, that was the one case where I took it as, this is a production. This is not a game. And I can see where actors and, you know, people who work in movies or whatever entertainment can be like, I don't want to work with this person anymore. I don't want to do it because it wasn't any fun. I could totally see that.
Do you think it affected your gaming?
It absolutely did. It absolutely did. And I'm in a way that even now when I'm running, because I'm currently running a Savage World pirate campaign.
Okay.
And I'm running this game going, and I'm not doing it on mic. I'm just doing it for fun. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, this is, I'm not doing it right. I don't have that safety net of being able to take things out of perspective or take things and move them around. And so the pressure, it seems, is more on me to do it live than it is doing it recorded. It's one of the things that I tried to work out is my working out of that comfort zone. Because people always want to say, you want to work out of your comfort zone. And it almost became a comfort zone where I'm running games thinking about the production rather than thinking about the player's fun.
So what did you learn from all of that that you would take to your game? Because obviously there's some negative lessons in there, a production certainly gives you an opportunity to fix all the things that went wrong in the game, to fix the things that weren't delivered well or whatever. But were there any positive lessons? Was there anything that you got out of doing this that you think lets you take back and make your games better?
For the most part, yes. When it comes to story development, it taught me that not to have something completely like worked out from beginning to end, allow the players a little bit more freedom to do their own thing, things like that. Because before I was very much a railroad game master. We're going to get on the tracks and this is the game that we're going to play. Now I'm much more interested in players having fun, getting them engaged, letting them do things with NPCs rather than trying to just keep the story moving in that way. So I think it loosened me in that regard. Actual plays can be fun, but I think for me, sitting down and playing with my friends has become much more important than, trying to worry about story and all that stuff too.
I find that side of things interesting because after doing this podcast as long as I have, and there are other people, well, of course, Aisha's now doing the editing full time. And before that, there were two other hosts that took brief stints doing the editing. But for most of the show's run, I was the one doing the editing. And I found that when I had to sit there and listen to myself, listen to my own speech, that, of course, the first thing you have to get past is your own voice. Right? Nobody likes the way their own voice sounds. But there was a lot of things I learned about the way that I speak that I think has improved not just my speech on the podcast, but my public speaking in general. Slowing down, enunciating better, getting points across more clearly. Yes, I still have my idiosyncrasies in the way I speak that are just who I am and I don't intend to change them. But there were a lot of things that I think I had to see in listening to so many, I mean, what worked out to be hundreds of hours of my own speaking. And I would have to imagine, once again, we've not done an actual play. There's been a couple times we've put a mic on the table while we're playing or something, but we've not done anything approaching a produced actual play. But it seems it would have to make you realize a lot of things about your games that maybe you don't notice until somebody does the instant replay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Somebody in sports watching game tapes, right? You're constantly evaluating what you're doing and how you're running things and should I have said this? Should I have said that? And that actually drove a lot of the scripted stuff that I did was I should have ran it this way or I should have said this here instead of this. And being able to make those adjustments, sitting down at the table now and playing, a lot of that stuff I think has become so ingrained that I don't even really think about it anymore, the way that I speak and the way that I project things at a table. I can project at a game table at a con enough that everybody at the table can hear me because I'm used to projecting my voice now because of the podcast. Being able to speak in public, and like you said, you're public speaking, you're talking to maybe people you don't even really know. You can still kind of fall into that ability. And I think when you're doing an actual play, that helps too because you're used to talking about your game and talking about what's going on in the game. So when you do have a spectator come and watch, it really isn't that intimidating anymore.
As I sit here and I listen to you talk about this, I find myself wondering if, so let's say for a moment, we're not talking about a podcast or to anyone who's contemplating doing an actual play podcast. We're just talking to the average person that's listening to the show right now. And let's say that said person is a game master or has an interest in the craft of game mastering and, you know, maybe has a little bit of extra time, likes listening to gaming content over the course of the week. I realize for a lot of people, this is just going to be like, wow, this is boring non-starter. So I don't think this is going to be one size fits all. But it starts making me wonder that if there's somebody who really wants to dissect, to really up themselves to that next level, that maybe there is a value in putting a phone or a digital voice recorder or something on the middle of the table, recording the game session, and then while you're at work or while you're doing housework or working out or whatever it is you do during the course of the week, listening to that. And forcing yourself to sit through even the most cringeworthy moments, because now suddenly you start to hear all the things that are going on. You suddenly notice that someone hasn't spoken in 30 minutes. You suddenly notice that this part of your game was actually really boring, or I don't know. You catch things on the second pass that you wouldn't have caught if you had just done it and walked away. And if that ups your game in terms of the performance you put on for your players, then does it by extension also increase the game or the performance that you put on for a bystander?
I think that doing an actual play requires a tremendous amount of courage. My players and I have actually talked about that because one of my gaming fantasies has always been to have a stenographer. I want to have someone in the room typing out what has occurred, and then later have a transcript of the game. We've talked about putting a phone or using a microphone and recording the game, but I have to say, I don't think I am brave enough to listen to my game mastering, because I think I'd be really, really hard on myself. But the other thing that I think that would be interesting about doing it is I suspect, and maybe I'm wrong, but I suspect that your level of preparation as a game master, the level of effort that you put into thinking about the game, was significantly more after doing the actual plays.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Something that you were talking about, I got so many notes because I wouldn't have to write them down. If I listened to that day's recording or the night before the recording, and I could just listen to it from beginning to end, I wouldn't have to take notes at the table of what somebody said or things like that. If I could always incorporate some of the things that the players were saying after the fact, and I wouldn't have to remember it or go, ooh, I need to write that down. Because, you know, it's a big tell, right? You know, the game master just wrote that down. Something bad's going to happen. I shouldn't have said that. I'm loading the gun, right?
Do you use a GMing shield thingy when you...
I'm kind of anti-shield. And the reason I do that is because I like to roll out in the open to get the reaction. And I'll give you a good example of that. One of the actual plays that I did was Call of Cthulhu.
By the way, I think this is great because you're throwing Chris under the bus right now. Because he just got a note from somebody saying that she feels bad for Chris because Chris is 100% right that GM screens are not just an option in gaming, they're a necessity.
that's a whole banter topic right there.
Oh, yeah.
Because I used to be very pro GM screen and now I don't use one anymore at all.
Yeah. So, all right, but go on.
Example was I did a Call of Cthulhu actual play, and what I did was I led it off with a TPK. So I wiped the entire group and then had them make characters related to their previous characters, and they had to investigate the deaths.
That's right? Metal.
Yeah.
And
it's hardcore.
And what we did was we recorded that. It was a pre-session. So everybody went into the game thinking this was going to be my character for the actual play.
Yeah, see, the only thing shitty about that is that they put effort into making that character.
Not only that, I made...
he says with glee in his eyes.
I made the players do research.
It was man.
It was
I don't know that I ever won a game with you.
What a way to set the Cthulhu mood, though. Like, this is going to suck from moment one.
Right. So
you're all dead. Yeah. Now read.
Right. So they all, like my friend Jason, I got up. It was set 1920 St. Louis. Okay. And I said to my friend Jason, I got a book on the gangs of the 20s, the Prohibition era gangsters. And I had a book and I go, read this.
I call them heroes.
Yes.
Anheuser-Busch, yes.
So I said, you know, read this. So he's reading a book about gangsters because he's playing a gangster character. And then I killed his character. And then his next character wasn't even a gangster. So he had him, I had him do this research on gangsters, and he didn't even really need
it. You made him read an entire book?
So,
wow!
But to my point about the GM screen was there is one point in the TPK where two of the player characters see something that they shouldn't have seen. Something so bad that the sanity penalty was D100, and I roll 00 right out there in the open. And everybody saw it. And one of the players goes, "What does that mean?" They had no clue what it meant. And I kept all of that.
Double because rainbow.
There was a double rainbow.
Double rainbow. What does it mean?
So,
double zero. What does it mean? It's almost triple zero.
So, and that's, you know, that was a very poignant moment because it was like, what do we do? And so I kept all of that because those are the things you can't recreate. And so, you know, as an actual play, even highly produced ones, that's the goal, right? That's the gems you would keep. But, and it's also one of the reasons why I never use a Game Master screen. It's because I want the players to see what I roll. And, you know, I don't fudge dice or anything like that. Shadowrun, you know, and they hate it. Oh God, they hate it. When I roll the big bucket of dice, you know, I'm going to do this, and I go, okay, here's your, you know, the person you're is attacking you, here's the defense. And they're like, you know, so it's those things that the actual plays, I could listen to that particular moment over and over again because it's still just fresh in my mind, and it was years ago.
Right. And I've talked about this before on the mics, that there's those moments in gaming. I mean, for the most part, I hate gaming, but there are those.
Wait a second. I'm confused.
But there are those magic moments, right, that are so good, it makes all the effort worth it, right? And by recording it, you save those moments for posterity. I think that's really, really a good idea.
Honestly, that is the basis for everything that I have done up to this point.
Because, like, I have a line from my current D&D game that I just relive in my head. One of my players, sorry, gaming story alert, one of my players in the game decided that, look, I need to take a break from everything that we're doing. I'm going to go on walkabout. And so we decide to engineer an entire 2-year break for the party, where they're going to go off and going to do their own thing, and we're going to advance time. One of the players, the bard in the party, had a relationship with the local madam. Like, they were a thing, right? And she's very sort of clingy and obsessive and maybe boil your bunny.
Was she an NPC or another?
She's an NPC. Okay. And so the bard's character comes back. He's back in town. He's in town for like a day and doesn't even go and see her. So she shows up at his house. He opens the door and she slaps him really, really hard on the face. Starts crying and walks away, right? So he goes back about his business. Come to find out, she had a miscarriage shortly after he left. And he was really, really upset about it. And she was upset. And there was a moment where she looked at him and she said, "Every man who ever loved me leaves. My father, you, and now our son."
Wow. Mike, did you just drop a mic right there and walk out?
And the whole table stopped and looked at me. And Brent, like, I mean, it's been months ago because we only play once per month, which sucks. But, like, every time I see him, every time I talk to him, I mean, he's just livid that I killed his kid. So I joke with him and I'm like, well, wait till you find out what really happened.
I was expecting the story to end with you having realized that this was pretty much the pinnacle of gaming for you and just having to kill everyone at the table.
But you have those moments, like, I wish I had the audio of that, because that moment at the table for everybody was just so, it's like opium. It's like chasing the dragon. Like, it's just so hard to get there. But when you do, it's so bloody good.
You know, and we talk about the difficulty, the uncomfortableness of gaming in front of other people, of getting into character in front of other people, of doing the voices, of acting silly, of putting yourself out there. And, you know, I know for some people, gaming is not an exercise. Gaming is just what they do to escape. It's what they do for fun. That, you know, trying to take it to the next level is just plain. It's pointless, right? It's not really what they want out of it. And that's 100% cool. I think I'm probably one of those people myself that, this podcast aside, I do sometimes worry that some of the groups I've been in took gaming and themselves a bit too seriously.
Oh, guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm absolutely guilty of that.
And so,
what do you mean by that when you say you take yourselves too seriously? Like, what do you mean? I'm not quite sure.
Well, what I mean is that you look for these ways to improve your game. You want certain things out of a game. You want character depth and high drama, and you set these really high expectations. And
you read books. You read books and blogs about game mastering advice.
I just wasn't sure what you meant by you
listen to podcasts about game mastering advice. But you get yourself on that podcast about game mastering advice.
But sometimes it's just like, man, have we gotten to the point where we're so serious it's not fun anymore?
Well, that's why I was trying to clarify. I didn't know what you meant by it.
But for some people, I wonder if there would be a value in just accepting that spectator, because if you can push yourself to keep the weird with somebody watching, then it breaks down a whole lot of concerns. When I first started doing podcasting, I think it was somewhat easier because of the fact that the room was either empty or had a minimal number of my friends in it. But there's a lot of things about speaking in public, talking to strangers, someone who has social anxiety, that not just podcasting, but then going on to do conventions, to do panels, to do public speaking, has helped me get past a lot of the things that used to hold me back psychologically. And I wonder if in the same way that if having that spectator, accepting them as just part of the equation, it's kind of like, you know, if I can do it in front of this random guy lurking behind me at the game shop.
Right, because there's a tremendous amount of intimacy. I mean, for me as a gamer, what you are sharing, here are my thoughts, my reactions, my ideas, my creativity. And that is challenging to share in a group of people who you know and trust. But now then to present that to strangers and have somebody, you know, being a voyeur, it sometimes can be difficult.
Yeah, and actually, Eric, that's probably the thing I wanted to ask you in closing is, when I game master, when most people game master, they get feedback from their players. If you do it at a con, you may not get feedback at all. If you do, it's going to be generally positive or at least polite. The people who kind of stop by and watch for 30 seconds and wander off probably won't say anything at all. But when you did a podcast with an actual play, people feel a whole lot more emboldened to give you pretty raw takes on things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And for the most part, it's been good. It's been positive.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to say about actual plays is, for the most part, the people who really enjoy actual play are either people who play it or game masters who want to hear, you know, maybe the craft or something like that. But a lot more, it's people who don't have their own game.
That's something that had crossed my mind earlier on. I'm glad you brought it up because I slipped me. Was I know doing even a show that doesn't have an actual play, we get a lot of people that contact us saying, your show is what fills the gap for me not having a gaming group or not having people that I can discuss these things with. And I've got to think how much more so with an actual play, because it's as close as you get to having an RPG without having an RPG.
Right. And, you know, with your listeners, you've got people who recognize your voice. You've been around for 11 years. You know, you've got people who know your personalities and things like that. That next level, I think your fans would absolutely eat it up because they know you so well, or at least they feel that they know you so well that next level, it's like they would be actually sitting down at the table and playing with you. And right. that's what I got. That's the feedback mostly that I got was, you guys are just like my guys, you know, my group used to be. And you got the one guy who's always goofy and the one person who takes things way too seriously. And, you know, you've got this mix of all these different players. And I could just totally see me and my friends sitting down and playing every time I listen. So that's the positive of it, right? It's you're able to express the stories and things like that. But really, it's people just want to listen to the personality.
Do you find that your fans like the more produced games, like the gaming podcast that you put out versus the raw? Like, is there like a, I'm just curious, like what people, I know there's, you talked about people arguing over rules and some things being pretty boring, but sometimes some of that stuff adds character to the game and it shows how, like, quote unquote, human you are and lets you kind of understand the people a little bit more through the mics because you're just listening to them through the speakers. And I was just curious, like, if you'd gotten feedback from your listeners on if they prefer one style versus the other.
Yes, there is a clear two camps on that. It's some don't like the overproduced. They, you know, if I wanted to listen to audio drama, I'd listen to Audible. you know, or I'd listen to something else. I want to listen to a game being played. I want to hear dice on the table. I want to hear the arguments. I want to hear somebody, you know, go for 20 minutes talking about how smelly somebody's fart was or something like that. I mean, that's just, you know, people, they, and those are mostly the people who don't have games themselves.
What made me think about it as people who don't have their own games.
So the question that I have is that, can you ride that fence? Can you have a foot in both camps? Can you have a well-produced, polished actual play that still has the elements of a live at-the-table game?
I think audio is so limited in that fashion that it would almost have to be a video podcast to do it, because that way you would still get that feeling of people being around the table, but you could still produce it a different way, having the players do their thing or whatnot, and then cutting away to maybe an actor doing interaction or something like that. I've tried to do both. I've tried to do just straight actual play. I've tried to do highly produced things like that. And, you know, it's hard because you want to get the most people, the most interest, and you can't please everybody.
Right.
So ultimately, you just really got to please yourself.
Right. Yeah. Because you're doing it as a.
I was totally waiting for it.
You guys.
Because Dan and I have talked about this off the mics, and I'm a firm believer
pleasing
in that.
Ourselves.
Yeah. Oh my God. I just lost my train of thought. Because now I'm thinking about Joe Con, like an entire con about masturbation. Anyway.
Oh my goodness.
There's spittoon like buckets in the corner.
Oh, okay. No more coffee for you. You are cut off.
I will have you know, just because there's a lady on the show, I have not restrained myself. So what I was going to say, and Dan and I have talked about this off the mics, I'm a firm believer in that for me as a gamer, gaming is always better in the retelling. So the polished podcast actual play is more interesting to me as a listener, I think, because all of my gaming stories, game master or player, are always better in the retelling for me.
Yeah. And one of the positive aspects of the polished stuff is everybody wants to be a badass, right? So you're going to play your character and listening, you know, as a player, that nothing cooler than to listen to your character being, you know, you playing your character, you being the actor, and then having your own theme music or having, you know, and I've done that too, you know, in the Shadowrun production that I did, the very beginning is basically the fixer getting the team together. And she has to call everybody. And every time she called a different person, there was different background music. And it was their theme music. And people were like, oh, man, that when the music kicked in, just made me feel like a badass.
Yeah.
And everybody wants that. So
side topic, what would your theme music be? Oh, like, man. If you were in a stadium and you're getting ready to walk out, or you were an elf getting ready to head into battle, right. And you had, what music would you have?
I'm partial to the Sanford and Son theme song.
What about you, Mike?
I don't have a good, like, walk-on, I'm a badass song, but there's a band called Morphine, and they have a song, and basically the lyrics are, you know, on my dying day, I'll be able to say that I finally see things all your way. And it's all about how you're always wrong. But maybe when I'm going to die, I'll admit that you're right. And that's my jam.
Yeah. Dan, I don't know that I know yours.
Blind Guardians and The Story Ends.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Interesting.
What would yours be?
Mine's not really like an epic battle song. It's more my Latina style coming out with Danza Cururo. It's a great song. Every time I hear it, I can't like not dance.
Honestly, she doesn't need to pick a particular song. So every so often, she'll turn on the TV and set up one of the music channels.
Oh, yeah.
And she goes to this Latin dance channel.
It's not Latin dance. It's salsa merengue.
Yeah, okay. Mm. But honestly, the point being that it's pretty much one song that just lasts as long as she leaves the TV on. Like, you literally cannot distinguish one song. No, Chad backed me up on this.
Oh, come on. Yeah, that's obviously a completely different.
There's one person who does like the sound of their own voice.
Yes. Is you cannot tell where one song ends and the next one begins. They just all blur together. They have basically the same rhythm, basically the same instrumentation.
Wow, you were just saying like Hispanics have no musical diversity.
I'm saying that particular style of music is like that.
I don't know. It's awesome. It's great.
I love Spanish guitar.
Yeah.
It's so good.
I'd have to look up some of the names, but there are a few both modern and romantic Spanish classical composers that are outstanding.
You can't walk out into anything with a Spanish classical guitar composer.
If I had I'm a super badass, it would be Gwar's The Horror of Yig. Like, if you just play the first 20 seconds of that song, like, I could kill a tree. Like, I could just tear it down with my own teeth. It's so good.
I will say that some of the best music out there is by Audio Machine, or there's a couple other bands out there. They just play that epic, movie trailer music. It's just powerful stuff. And pretty much anything that those bands put out, like Two Steps from Hell, Audio Machine, that's great. Like, battle music. It's not actually in a lot of battle scenes from video games. Like, you know, the actual scenes for the cutaways and things like that. Anyway, I digress.
If I was going to talk about Chad Lovey, the sound of his voice, it would be in terms of how to tell a gaming story. maybe this is where we'll end the show. But it would be in terms of how to tell a gaming story. Because it is my firm belief that what most people need, everybody thinks they need public speaking classes. They don't. It is my opinion the vast majority of people I've talked to who think they need public speaking classes actually need an essay writing class. Because what an essay writing class teaches you to do, if they're well structured, is one, you have to start off with a conclusion. And notice I did that. Secondly, you have to give your supporting points, usually organized into individual thoughts, which I'm doing right now. And then third, if they're well-structured, they're going to ask you to do it in not a lot of space, not as in like, well, we need you to fill 20 pages, but the reverse. We want you to explain why you feel the way you do about a controversial and complicated subject in one page. And then you have to end by restating where you began, and that is why I think people need an essay writing class.
Well, the slow clap for you, sir.
So, public speaking, I don't need, because this is a story for another time, but I got jackhammered and did the safety speech for a bunch of dune buggies on a Caribbean island before they pulled me down, because they didn't think I'd do it, and I did.
Blue Curacao helped with that a little bit.
And that was the island we were on. They gave me the drink, they gave me the island, I gave the safety speech, and then they pulled me down. So, anyways, another story for another time. Thank you guys for tuning in. Thank you, Eric, for joining us.
Thank you.
And you guys have a great week and great games, and we will catch you next time.
Adios.
This has been a production of Fear the Booth, copyright 2017. Listeners are free to use this episode in any non-commercial endeavor so long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the RPG Academy network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at therpgacademy.com/network.